And then we could tell that something very terrible was happening.
And then what happened? Did you all go to the hospital?
The cavalcade immediately speeded up at a very high speed and raced. It was some miles to the hospital. They raced past the place where the noon meeting was to be held, past the mart where thousands of people were gathered inside, and went directly to the hospital at a terrible rate of speed. This was a deed without a name. This is one of the most horrible crimes in American history, and it takes away the most brilliant leader I've ever known at a crucial time in the history of the world. This is an unspeakable tragedy to the family and to the nation.
Senator Yarborough, were you with President Kennedy, talking with him this morning before this occurred?
Oh, before the cavalcade. Oh, yes, I've talked with him. He was optimistic and enthusiastic about things in Texas. The crowds were so great. The people had turned out with such great greetings. There were so many more than were there when he came in 1960, and so much more enthusiastic. It was, someone said that, well, Mrs. Kennedy was enjoying it, too. The people wanted to see her, so, and the crowds were so vast and so cheerful and so glad to see her, to see him.
Did you see her, Mrs. Kennedy, afterwards at the hospital?
Yes, I saw Mrs. Kennedy after that. I think the whole nation, the whole world, sorrows with her at the loss of her husband, and the father of our children, and this great leader of this nation and the free world.
Thanks.
This is the saddest day I've known in American history, my lifetime.
Thank you very much, Senator Yarborough. This is Nancy Dickerson of NBC News at Andrews Air Force Base.
Before now, we have briefly quoted the ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, the man who ran against President Kennedy in 1960, or tried to, for the nomination, who was later appointed to stewardship at a very sensitive level of our government. Now it's time, there's an opportunity to hear what Adlai Stevenson says in person about the death of President Kennedy.
The tragedy of this day is beyond instant comprehension. All of us who knew him will bear the grief of his death to the day of ours. And all men everywhere who love peace and justice and freedom will bow their heads. At such a moment, we can only turn to prayer. Prayer to comfort our grief, to sustain Mrs. Kennedy and his family, to strengthen President Johnson, and to guide us in time to come. May God help us.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have later advices from Texas on the manhunt for President Kennedy's killer or killers. Lee Oswald, the 24-year-old American, the renegade who went to Russia, the man who admires Fidel Castro, is still in custody. It's been several hours now. After 2 hours of questioning, the Dallas police report, they're technically in charge, although they're not entirely in charge of this operation, that Lee Oswald has denied any connection with the shooting, either of the policemen who was shot near a theater where Oswald was captured, or he has denied any connection with the shooting of the President of the United States. He's still under questioning, and the witnesses have not confronted him as yet. It is very important that so many people disagree. It happens in automobile accidents. Why shouldn't it happen in other events that are not exactly accidents? It is important that so many disagree as to how many shots were fired. We now are advised officially from the hospital, and no doubt the autopsy on the president's body tonight in Bethesda Naval Hospital near Washington will bear this out, that the president was shot twice. Now, it has been reported before that Governor John Connally with him in the car was shot twice, and yet witnesses heard only three shots. We do know for sure that the president has been shot twice. It is possible that one of the shots of the three also struck the governor, or maybe two. But in any event, he has been shot twice. And by the way, they have operated on Governor John Connally. A lung has been reinflated that had collapsed as a result of the wounds He had been shot in the back, one of the major shots. But it is still the report in Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas, that Governor John Connally is, while he's in serious condition, is not in critical condition, and that he continues to show improvement at this time. Incidentally, the president's body was brought to Washington in a bronze casket. It was placed in a military ambulance to be taken to the Naval Hospital at Bethesda. It will remain there during the night for the autopsy, which, as we reported to you before, is routine in such official deaths, as the president of the United States in circumstances that are beyond the natural. And a full and complete report will be in the history books of the nation concerning the manner of the death and the cause of the death, the accurate details of the President of the United States. That's why the body was taken to Bethesda Naval Hospital near Washington. It will go to the White House tomorrow morning, where it will lie in repose for the private mourning of the family and for those who were close to the Kennedy family, either in the official family of the cabinet and others, or in the Congress. But this is a private act. The body in repose at the White House. Later it will be taken to the Capitol, where it will lie in the rotunda for the public, lying in state for the tribute of the nation at large. Foreign policy, of course, has been the urgent concern of the president. The speech he did not deliver in Dallas today, one of the speeches he was to have made there, dealt almost exclusively with the foreign policy of the United States and our place in the world today. One of the nations where we've been having difficulty in foreign policy has been Brazil, where insistent but minority left-wing elements have almost captured the government, where Brazil has taken exception to Kennedy policies regarding the Alliance for Progress. Brazil wanted direct relations with Washington in alliance money. They wanted control of alliance money, but their government has shown very little responsibility in handling such money for the simple reason there has been 67% inflation, at least in Brazil. But the Brazilian people today showed an attitude that their government has not revealed to us lately. And I think it fitting at this time that we go now to Wilson Hall in Rio de Janeiro.
Hundreds of Brazilians converged on the American embassy tonight to assure them of something they cannot or don't want to believe, that President Kennedy is dead. All radio and television stations were off the air today because of the strike, so the news of President Kennedy's death spread by word of mouth. The foreign minister presented Brazil's official condolence to American Ambassador Lincoln Gordon. Rio de Janeiro is to have an official 5-day period of mourning for late President Kennedy. President Kennedy was very popular personally down here. They liked President Kennedy because he was young, because of his faith, and because of his interest in Latin America. Brazilians, I would say, are shocked, saddened, and even angered at the news of President Kennedy's assassination. People stop me on the street and ask if I am an American. When I say yes, they all say, what a great tragedy, and we all offer our condolences. One told me, how can you Americans allow such things to happen to your president? And one person called the office of Time magazine here and asked, what's the matter with you Americans? You murder two presidents who try to free the slaves. Wilson Hall, NBC News, Rio de Janeiro.
It's a fairly odd comment for a nation or among the people of a nation that have had many tragedies of this kind in history and know more about assassination of officers than most. Incidentally, NBC's Nancy Dickerson in Washington reports that Senator Hubert Humphrey has related a tragically ironic comment that President Kennedy recently made. And before we get to the comment, we should explain it. President Ramiro Betancourt of Venezuela has been under attack from both right and left. The right-wing Trujillo people from Santo Domingo tried to kill him when he entered into the presidency of Venezuela. And the communists, the Castro communists, have made no less than 15 attempts on the life of Betancourt. He was once severely injured in the last 4 years, and if he should end his term, this time it will be the first time that a president of Venezuela has served a 4-year term, complete. Before now, either a dictator's taken over or some tragedy has occurred. In relation to that, Mr. Kennedy recently remarked to Hubert Humphrey, the senator from Minnesota, that, you know, he said, I always worry about President Betancourt of Venezuela and the possibility that he may be assassinated, meaning that as a friend of the United States, this man is a stalwart in Latin America. Actually, 24 people have been killed in violence initiated by Castro communists in Caracas, Venezuela, within the last few days, and scores have been wounded, hundreds have been arrested as Castro conspirators. Incidentally, the mourning of other nations is beginning to appear, shall we say, more intense than perhaps we first realized. It's not all limited to statements by high officials. As we've heard from Joseph Harsh in London, the feeling of the Prime Minister was very clearly showing through everything he said about the death of President Kennedy. And for a surprising to us, surprising reaction, we take you now to Wells Hengen in Bonn, Germany.
How are you, Morgan?
How are you, Wells?
Pretty good.
What have you got to report this time?
Well, the West German Chancellor, Ludwig Erhard, has come back from his talks in Paris. He got off the train here in Bonn and was visibly shaken by the news, which he'd received by radio telephone on the special train that brought him back. He went directly from the railway station to the radio studio here in Bonn, where he made a very emotional short tribute to the president and said that the German people would now stand at the side of the American people. Erhard has also indicated, not directly but through his foreign minister, Gerhard Schröder, that he will be coming to the States for the funeral. As you know, Erhard had been scheduled to leave on Sunday night for talks with Mr. Kennedy on Monday and Tuesday in Washington. Of course, that is no longer possible, but he will be coming for the funeral, although he doesn't know when that will be or when he'll be leaving.
Well, that is a most touching development. I think Americans are, in recent months, have not been prepared for an emotional outpouring of a friendly nature from other people. And I am sure that perhaps, or do you think, that the Chancellor has that in mind when he has decided to come here?
Yes, I think he does. I think he felt himself very close to the president, even though they didn't know each other intimately. They had met several times. Most recently, when Mr. Kennedy was here in Germany, he made his triumphal official visit at the end of June, and a speech that is now enshrined in history in Berlin, in which he said, I am a Berliner, and that, of course, the memory of that visit is still very fresh with people here. And Berliners particularly have been shaken by the news tonight.
He issued this statement today from Independence, Missouri. I am shocked beyond words at the tragedy that has happened to our country and to President Kennedy's family today. The president's death is a great personal loss to the country and to me. He was an able president, one the people loved and trusted. Mrs. Truman and I send our deepest sympathy to Mrs. Kennedy and the family. Mrs. Truman said her husband will attend the funeral. She said she has not decided whether she will accompany the former president. Getting back to the background and the career of Lyndon Johnson, the new president of the United States, the people in Washington who observed them most closely noted that Mr. Johnson and Mr. Kennedy were not intimate friends, but even though this was so, the late president gave Mr. Johnson many assignments, goodwill missions abroad, and the chairmanships of the Equal Opportunities Commission and the Space Advisory Council at home. He regularly attended cabinet and National Security Council meetings and Kennedy's weekly conferences with congressional leaders. It has not always been so, and this is extremely important in this administration. Mr. Johnson's background in the Senate, his tremendous involvement in all of the affairs of the Senate as its leader during all of the years he so successfully led it from the Democratic Party point of view, all of this gives him a tremendous amount of knowledge of these things where knowledge is most urgently required. And his trips abroad, he went to Europe and he went to Latin America. Mr. Johnson was very well acquainted with leaders of these people. And I think one of the most important things to remember in connection with this is that, like Mr. Kennedy, he was a professional politician in what should be considered the best sense, a professional politician in the sense that he lived, breathed, and ate politics all of the time, which means not just the affairs of a party or of two parties or of a district, but the affairs of the nation and its problems and its needs. He kept regularly abreast of these things, and this has not always been the case with vice presidents of the United States. Mr. Nixon was well acquainted with affairs of government, and President Eisenhower made sure that this was the case. However, before that time, Mr. Truman himself had far less acquaintance with the problems of the government and the workings and functionings of the government than did either Vice President Nixon or now, in this case, Mr. Johnson, the new President of the United States. The trips abroad were consequential. The chairmanship of the Equal Opportunities Commission means that Mr. Johnson can speak with authority of the problems of civil rights in which he concerned himself. The Space Advisory Council, of which he was chairman, is extremely important because our space program is, again, one of the problems that he must face. Congress has already lowered the boom on part of the funds for the presidential space program, and there is now a strong question as to whether this program will be put into effect in time, as was promised, to get a rocket, manned rocket, to the moon and back in this decade. This, again, is a problem of vast scope, one that Mr. Johnson does know. Turning to other problems, we have the other question of Mr. Johnson's health, which should be considered. If you will remember, Mr. Johnson did suffer a heart attack 8 years ago. But today, heart specialists predicted that he would be a vigorously healthy chief executive despite this. They based their estimate upon the vigorous life Mr. Johnson has led since his months-long recuperation in 1955. He has, as the saying goes, been through the political wars, including the 1960 election campaign as President Kennedy's running mate, and has even faced a mob, one specialist recalled. In the unanimous opinion of three specialists, a man such as Mr. Johnson, who has had a complete recovery of years-long duration, can face up to the most exacting task, including that of being president. They pointed to the example of President Dwight David Eisenhower, who suffered a heart attack during his first term, but went on to win re-election and still, as we all know, is vigorously and happily healthy. The question of the last rites is one which involves all of America, too. And here are the figures and here are the facts in that area. The last rites for President John F. Kennedy will be performed in Washington Monday at a pontifical requiem mass, which will be celebrated by Richard Cardinal Cushing, Archbishop of Boston. This was announced by the White House tonight in a statement which also said that former Presidents Eisenhower and Truman would arrive in Washington this weekend to join mourning dignitaries. The slain president's body will lie in repose in the East Room of the White House from 10 in the morning until 6 in the evening tomorrow, it was announced. Only the immediate Kennedy family will be present for the first hour, that is, between 10 and 11. No one from the public or from the dignitaries present will be allowed in at that time. President Johnson will head a high-ranking group which will view the body in repose between 11 and 2. Former President Eisenhower will be present at that time, according to the White House announcement, as will Speaker of the House John McCormick and Chief Justice Earl Warren. The body of President Kennedy will lie in state in the rotunda of the Capitol on Sunday and Monday, according to the White House. Mr. Truman plans to arrive in Washington on Sunday. Former President Herbert Hoover has expressed his regret that he will be unable to attend. It was announced by the White House. The former Republican president had a serious operation last year and has been ailing. He is a man of great age. Kennedy's body, the president's body, will be moved to an official cortege from the White House to the rotunda of the Capitol at 1 p.m. Sunday. It will lie in state there until Monday at 11 a.m. And at that time, of course, all of his fellow Americans who wish to see him will be able to do so. His body will be moved at that time to St. Matthew's Cathedral in downtown Washington for a pontifical requiem mass at noon. This will be celebrated by Cardinal Cushing. The public will be permitted to file past the bier in the rotunda shortly after its arrival and until 9 p.m. on Sunday, the announcement said, and then again from 9 to 10 a.m. on Monday. I think I should repeat that. The public will be permitted to file past the bier in the rotunda shortly after its arrival and until 9 p.m. on Sunday and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Monday. We are just informed that Ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, has arrived in Washington, and we have more for you on that now.
For the obsequies and the ceremonies that will take place tomorrow, and I said this afternoon in New York that I thought that, that the tragedy of this day is beyond any instant comprehension. And all of us who knew him will bear the grief of his death until the day of ours. And all men everywhere who love justice and freedom and peace will bow their heads. At such a moment, one can only turn to prayer. Prayer to comfort our grief, to sustain Mrs. Kennedy and his family, and to strengthen President Johnson and to guide us in time to come. May God help us all.
And the voice you undoubtedly recognize as that of Adlai Stevenson. One wonders if memories, rather recent memories, came to Mr. Stevenson when he heard this hideous news. Of the time when he was in Dallas just a short time ago, when right-wing pickets, who dislike his foreign policy and the administration's foreign policy generally, picketed him, and he actually got hit with a sign by one of them, an incident which he dismissed, but which perhaps he recalled now because of the president's death in Dallas. I think we've been talking about the career of Mr. Johnson for just a moment, and I think perhaps it might be appropriate for us to review some of the highlights in the career of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. His birth came on the 29th of May in 1917. He was born in Brookline, Massachusetts, the second of nine children to former ambassador to Great Britain, Joseph P. Kennedy, and his wife, Rose Kennedy. By the way, his body will be placed in the family plot in Brookline, Massachusetts. He graduated from Harvard cum laude in 1940 with a degree of Bachelor of Science. And in 1942, he wrote a book which was a best-selling book in the area of nonfiction. It was about the World War, and the book was Why England Slept. Between 1941 and 1945, he was, as I guess all of the world knows by now, thanks to a motion picture and thanks to all of the talk by all of the people who admired him, an officer in the United States Navy. He rose to the rank of lieutenant in command of a PT boat. In 1943, he was badly injured when his boat was rammed by a Japanese destroyer off the Solomon Islands, an occasion on which, again, as I assume almost everyone must know, he displayed tremendous heroism. Between 1947 and 1953, he served as a United States Congressman from Massachusetts. And this was the period during which one writer, who specialized in the area of the South Seas, tells of being in one such place. The name of the place doesn't come back to me at the moment. But a young man came through, he said, unattended by aides and unattended by official parties, wearing a wash-and-wear shirt, his armpits sweaty, a young man in a hurry. He came in and he said he wanted to know things. His name was John F. Kennedy. He didn't want to meet presidents and he didn't want to meet celebrities. He wanted to learn and he wanted to learn in a hurry. He was asked to whom did he want to speak. He said he wanted to speak to the newsmen. That was how he could learn. And this was the way he spent his life, learning as much as he possibly could and spending all of his time trying to do so. In 1952, John F. Kennedy was elected to the Senate of the United States, defeating for the first time Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. Two attractive young men from every possible point of view, both physical as well as intellectual, who met head-on. And Boston and its environs pushed Mr. Kennedy into the Senate. He liked the political fight, and he displayed it even at that time. In 1953, Senator Kennedy was married to Jacqueline Bouvier in Newport, Rhode Island. In 1954 and 1955, he was struck down by sickness, as has happened more than once to great men in the history of this country, and spent 6 months in the hospital undergoing and convalescing from major surgery on back injury, which was aggravated by the sinking of his PT boat. There were those who mourned for him even then as one whose life was just about gone, but the then Senator Kennedy refused to give in to this and fought back fiercely and successfully, even as he had during the war in which he had been a hero. In 1956, Senator Kennedy won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Profiles in Courage, one of the most quoted books of our time. In 1956, he narrowly missed winning the Democratic vice presidential nomination in Chicago, losing in a close contest to the late Senator Estes Kefauver, who was a Democrat from Tennessee, who also just recently died of a heart attack. I remember that contest very well. I was one of the correspondents, one of the many, many correspondents in Chicago, and it was an extremely interesting time. Adlai Stevenson was the nominee of the Democratic Party at that time, and he did not obey the usual procedure and protocol. He decided to throw the convention open. It was a peculiar time because you get swept up by conventions. All of us who were there, had we been thinking carefully, would have known that it didn't really make any difference. President Eisenhower had served a tremendously successful first term. He was greatly popular all over the country. The polls already indicated that there was nobody who had any conceivable chance to beat him. But the excitement of a convention is something that is completely unmeasurable by any standards that you can think of. And everybody thinks that anything can happen and that anybody can win. So that, therefore, when this convention was thrown open in 1956, there were caucuses and there were meetings called all over the hotels on the Chicago waterfront because the man who got the nomination was going to be the man who fought hardest for it during the night. And there were meetings called here and there. Somebody said, Senator Kennedy is having a meeting. And elsewhere, Senator Kefauver was calling a meeting. And the senior senator from Minnesota was having one. All of these people rushing back and forth, correspondents spending the night going from one meeting to another as the candidates tried to drum up strength to show that they had the popularity and the strength to get the nomination. Well, Mr. Kennedy, of course, did not get it. Estes Kefauver did. Perhaps at that time it was a favor to him because he would have been, of course, the vice presidential candidate on a losing ticket. This did not stop another candidate once, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but it could have done so in this case. Nevertheless, he was a loser at that time, but he learned something, and we all discovered at that time that the Kennedy family knew a great deal about politics and had to be looked for in the future. In 1957, he returned to the Senate again. He became the father of his first child, Carolyn. In 1958, he won re-election to the Senate by an overwhelming vote. The Kennedy family was already thinking in terms of the presidential nomination, and they ran as hard as ever they could. They organized the campaign to a fare thee well in Massachusetts. There was no question in anyone's mind that Senator Kennedy would be re-elected. But the important thing to the Kennedy hopes was that the election, the re-election, should be so strong that it would boost his presidential chances greatly. And this is what actually happened. In 1960, on July 14th, Mr. Kennedy won the Democratic presidential nomination on the first ballot, and all of the country stood back in awe at the political prowess that the Kennedy family and their supporters had showed during the entire campaign, the fight in Wisconsin and the fight in West Virginia and all through, the organization that they had displayed. Well, in 1960, President Kennedy then defeated Vice President Richard Nixon for the presidency in a close-fought ballot that gave him a final edge of scarcely 100,000 ballots. 1961, he became the father of a son, John Jr., his second child. 1961, too, in April, he started to have problems with Cuba, and Cuba seems to have haunted President Kennedy's life. He took full responsibility at that time for the ill-fated Cuban invasion, which was staged by dissident exile groups, and there was vast dispute over the extent the United States had promised aid and the extent to which it should have, under any circumstances, given aid. In 1962, in October, he forced Russia to withdraw its missiles, the missiles that it had secreted in Cuba with atomic warheads, and all of the world breathed a sigh of relief. In 1964, he was assassinated on November 22nd. This, a very brief thumbnail sketch, hardly, certainly not satisfactory, but there'll be more in this area later. Overseas, our friends have been mourning with us, those who admired the president, other chiefs of state. The BBC this afternoon, or rather this evening, had a tribute to Mr. Kennedy, which was begun by the Prime Minister, Conservative Prime Minister, Sir Alexander Douglas Hume.
In 3 short years of his presidency, he left an indelible mark on his country and on the world. And for us in Britain, his loss is a deep and a sad one, because he was the most loyal and faithful of allies. Tonight, I fear, there is no comfort that I can bring to the American people, nor indeed to ourselves, nor indeed to men anywhere who care for tolerance and liberty and justice and peace, unless it be this, that this dreadful deed should shock us all to dedicate ourselves anew to those things which he liked, which he loved, and for which he worked during his life. And if we can help to bring to men the liberty, justice, and peace for which he did so much, then we shall be doing something to serve the causes in the service of which he himself died. Now, waiting in our Manchester studio is Mr. Harold Wilson, the leader of the opposition.